from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny.
If we're really going to get to the bottom of these things, it's got to be done in a bipartisan fashion. And as far as I could tell, Congressman Nunez killed that.
That was Senator John McCain yesterday on ABC's This Week talking about the House Intelligence Committee's investigation into Russian election meddling and ties to the Trump campaign. We'll discuss that and all the latest political news with two national reporters. Join us after this news. Welcome to Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. Partisan rancor continues to thwart the House Intelligence Committee's investigation into Russian election meddling, as Senator John McCain said this weekend that committee chair Devin Nunes had effectively killed the investigation by failing to share information with Democrats. Meanwhile, the Senate Intelligence Committee carries on its own investigation, as does the FBI, which will also evaluate potential criminal charges against Trump campaign operatives. At the same time, the Senate Judiciary Committee is expected to approve the nomination of Neil Gorsuch today, as California Senator Dianne Feinstein announced that she will join her party's planned filibuster of the nominee. And we discuss these issues and others along with, let me tell you who is with us. Josh Meyer is with us from Washington, a senior investigative reporter with Politico, and we welcome you back to the program. Josh, good to have you.
Good to be back. Thanks.
Also want to welcome back Karum Demirjian, who is reporter with the Washington Post and also joins us this morning from the nation's capital. Welcome.
Thanks very much.
So good to have you both. And Josh, let me just begin with you. Is the House committee investigation, as McCain says, maybe at this point killed off, and we're looking at the Senate, but not necessarily looking at the possibility even of or are we looking at the possibility of an independent commission?
Well, that's a very good question. I think it depends on who you ask. If you ask Devin Nunes and some other people on the House Intelligence Committee, especially the Republicans, they would very vehemently disagree with that. He insists that he is ready and able and even willing to head this investigation. But even the minority members of his own committee are very, very skeptical of that. So we'll have to see what happens.
The Senate can maybe take it to a different level, or can they? There's talk about Manafort, Flynn. Maybe we can go into that. Maybe even Sally Yates, people that the House committee didn't see.
Yeah, the Senate, a rather remarkable sort of news conference last week where the ranking minority member and the chairman of the Senate committee, Senators Burr and Warner, acted sort of like the adults in the room and said, we're here, we're going to essentially take over this investigation, we're going to do it the way it needs to be done, and Senator Burr even said, we're going to follow the leads wherever they take us. And so they are certainly trying to position themselves as the ones who should lead this investigation. But Nunes is hanging in there, and there are still calls for an independent an independent commission of some sort to look into it as well, which many people are starting to think is the only way out of this with any kind of credibility.
Well, what are we to make, Karun Demirjian, of the fact that Michael Flynn, who once said, if you want immunity, it means you have probably criminal activity, has at least come forward with the likelihood of asking for immunity, and even President Trump has said he should ask for immunity. What do you make of it?
Well, either he's protecting himself because he does have something to say that could implicate himself, or he's sticking his foot also very far in his mouth based on his 2015 comments when he was commenting on people that worked for Hillary Clinton. It depends on really if he has anything to trade on, and that is also going to dictate whether or not he actually gets a positive response to this offer to tell people what he knows in exchange for immunity. But again, the fact that the offer has been made is not a given that it's going to be taken, and it also does not mean it's going to happen right away. The Senate Intelligence Committee has been pretty darn clear about the fact that while they are starting a bunch of interviews this week with people that they requested to speak with, they are not going to be jumping off and really, really quickly accepting these offers, these volunteer offers from Manafort, from Page, from Roger Stone, from Jared Kushner, and now this latest one from Flynn, which has conditions attached to it, until they're good and ready. And they want to go through several steps of this investigation until they get to that point, because basically this is a one-shot. It's an interview, not testimony, so it's behind closed doors. They're not under oath. And if there's something that comes up, they could insist upon a public testimony hearing next, but that's a step two, and as a step one, they have to make sure that they do, that they use it to its full extent, and they can't do that if they do it quickly.
Well, we do know that Flynn had meetings with the Russian ambassador, which he lied about, and we do know that Manafort was actually a foreign agent on behalf of Turkey, but also worked, and Flynn was a foreign agent on behalf of Turkey, but right. Manafort was also working for Yanukovych of Ukraine. There's a lot there that some would say, well, it's smoke. And now you have President Trump coming back and saying, let's investigate the Clintons and the uranium deal, and let's shift the focus. I suppose you could conclude that this is, as the Republicans are trying to paint it, a lot of smoke, maybe no fire?
Well, I think that's the big question, right? Is that where is the fire, and is there one there? And that's what this entire investigation is geared towards unearthing. Certainly, Republicans are trying to say that that the smoke is just been pumped into the room, and there never was a fire there in the first place, and this is all, you know, conspiracy theories, and the Democrats trying to pin something on Trump because they're still sore about having lost the election or lost the presidential election. And of course, Democrats are saying you can't have this many coincidences and this many people lining up and this much history of ties to Russia and their allies without it meaning something, without it coming down to a single thing, which is, you know, either going to be a politically wrong thing that was done, or perhaps some people are, you know, suggesting maybe it's even something that would be criminal. And now that we have discussions ongoing about, you know, well, who gets immunity for what, and what did they do, and what did they discuss? There's still so many unanswered questions there. We know about the context. We know about the phone calls. We don't necessarily know about all the details of what happened in them, and everything matters about the details. You can talk to Russians all the time. I used to be based in Moscow, right? I mean, I've talked to several Russians, including the Russian ambassador, but in what capacity did you talk to them? What did you discuss? And did you make any promises or get any sort of promise of reward for whatever the discussion, the meat of that discussion was? And that's stuff that we haven't answered yet.
Well, and Josh Meyer, Robert Kellner, who is Flynn's attorney, has been saying, and by the way, there may be a lot of testimony coming up in the Senate. We'll have to see what happens along those lines with Michael Flynn and the others that we've been mentioning here. But he used the language, and so did President Trump, witch hunt. We're hearing that from as high as the White House.
Right. Well, and you'll note that President Trump has said that, too, on many occasions in his tweets and in his public statements and so forth. Yeah, I mean, that's what I would expect a lawyer to do. When I first saw that Flynn had offered to testify, it did not strike me initially as that big of a story. I think that the media is making more of it than they need to. I think any good lawyer would try to get his client to do that. If you really parse what he's saying, he's not in any way suggesting that he's going to be giving anything up. He's certainly not saying he's going to roll over on anybody. I mean, my take is that his lawyer is just trying to do whatever he can to protect him, knowing that he's going to be called as a witness and just trying to get some sort of immunity. One thing that's important to note is you can't get immunity for a criminal investigation from Congress. You can get some sorts of qualified immunity, but ultimately the Justice Department and the FBI are the ones that need to grant immunity in a criminal investigation, which is what's going on here. And in order to do that, you have to submit what's known as a proffer. And in that, you know, your client basically outlines exactly what they're going to be doing, what information they're providing, what value it is to the government, and also that they can't get it anywhere else. And only then does the government decide whether this sort of proffer is something that we want to do, we want to engage in, and in exchange for that, give up something in return, including the conviction of somebody who at this point was the former national security advisor of the administration. So it's not taken lightly. And, some people have actually just called it a publicity stunt or a trial balloon just to see what's happening. You know, that being said, though, I think that, Flynn and some of these other people, Paul Manafort, so forth, do have some legal liability here. I mean, you know, Manafort himself is being investigated by not just the FBI and the Justice Department, but also the Treasury Department to see what kind of money flows are here, whether he declared the income, whether he registered as a foreign agent under the Foreign Agent Registration Act, and other factors that could come into play. So, you know, this could end up being a criminal case involving something much more minor, like disclosure of income.
Well, James Comey, the FBI has certainly opened that possibility. He's talked about criminal justice proceedings possibly being part of this, and Paul Manafort did take a $750,000 payment, we know. It was all reported in the New York Times, and Karun Demirjian, let me go back to you. And again, Josh Meyer is with us from Washington. He's senior investigative reporter for Politico, and Karun Demirjian is a reporter for The Washington Post. You know, there's a lot that we've discovered about Russian involvement. I mean, we know now, for example, that probably Paul Ryan and Marco Rubio had attempted hacking on them, and there was a social media campaign that goes back during the presidential campaign. Clint Wall's Foreign Policy Research Institute said we need to take active measures because it goes back probably Russia involved all the way to 2009. And the real, again, question mark here is how much can be laid at the door of Trump operatives or people in the Trump campaign or of those, for that matter, working for Donald Trump now?
Well, just to that's a pretty broad question about how much can be laid at the feet. I mean, the entire Russian information spinning propaganda campaign, can you lay that at the feet of the Trump campaign? Of course not. That's something that Russia has been at for years. I would just qualify that when we brought up Paul Ryan and Marco Rubio, those I don't think were so much hacks. I guess they could have been, but the context in which that that revelation was made last week was about how Russia basically uses this online army of fake accounts that are dressed up to look like they're real people from, you know, parts of America that are just like where you're from, can use those sorts of things in online attempts to discredit people. So that can be hacking in certain situations. It can also just be, you know, smear campaigns or dissemination of false information to try to sway people to think one way or another, that just go focus in on a target and really try to take them down and make them look terrible and bad through things that are not necessarily true.
Well, we know now they had Guccifer going. They had all these trolls. Yeah. I mean, this is all public knowledge.
Yeah. It's different. Right. It's exactly. So there's different things that all spin into this greater plan that the Kremlin allegedly has been focused on for several years now, and that it all kind of just came to a head in this last election cycle where they coordinated both the hacking activities and then the dissemination activities, because what good is a hack other than to just, you know, make that one person vulnerable, especially in politics, unless you can actually then take that information and use it to try to get something to change, to try to shift the balance of politics, to try to shift the balance of politics in the United States to Russia's betterment, whether that is some sort of concrete, specific foreign policy objective, or it's just to make the democratic system in the United States look so faulty that, you know, it weakens the United States by comparison, giving Russia a leg up while we're trying to figure this stuff up, but to focus on other areas where it's competitive or contest the United States and have this notch under its belt. So that's kind of the trajectory of that. How much of that ends up falling at the doorstep of the Trump camp depends on how deeply they were involved. If you get to the point where there's actual, you know, as some Democrats have alleged, where there's actual collusion to try to swing the election using these tools that Russia has made a point of not perfecting, but certainly honing over the last several years, that's very, very problematic. If it wasn't actually collusion, then that's far less problematic. And it depends, you know, what you prove at the end of the day depends on how much of this whole very, very finely tuned orchestration, you know, that happens on a regular basis with various public figures and that actually was something that the Trump team bought into, or if they didn't buy into it at all, then it's not at their feet. But that's the big question, right?
That is the big question indeed, among many big questions. And if you've just joined us, we're talking to a couple of veteran and seasoned reporters who are Washington-based about latest political news, including the Senate Intelligence Committee's rejection on Friday of an immunity deal for former National Security Advisor Michael Flynn, and intensifying partisan rifts in the House Intelligence Committee charged with investigating Russian election meddling. Josh Meyer with us, and Karun Demirjian also with us, and you can be with us as well. In fact, let me give out the the phone number and invite you to join us now. Our toll-free number is available. It's 866-733-6786. If you'd like to weigh in, we invite you to do so. If you have questions or comments about all that's swirling around out of Washington, we do welcome, again, you're joining the conversation. Toll-free, you can join us now at 866-733-6786. You can also email any questions or comments you might have, forum@kqed.org, or go right to our website, kqed.org/forum, and click on this segment, or tweet us. Our Twitter handle is @KQED Forum, and you can also, of course, put questions or comments on our Facebook page, and we'll go to your calls and emails and postings forthwith. I want to go back to Josh Meyer, though. We're doing a kind of roundup here, and I've got to talk about the Gorsuch nomination with you, Josh. I mean, Democrats look like they're moving toward filibuster, especially we heard Senator Feinstein today speaking after Charles Grassley essentially gave his endorsement of the Gorsuch nomination. What do you think, they have the votes at this point?
Well, you know, if you talk to Chuck Schumer, he said that we don't. So, you know, I think that it depends. That, you know, there's whips on both sides, I'm sure, that are counting up the votes right now. It seems like it's going to be close, but that could break one way or the other. Last time I checked, I think that there were three Democrats that said that they were voting for him. So that does not bode well for the Democrats. So, you know, I will watch with great interest. If I can return for one second to the Russia hacking thing, I think that there's two narratives that are starting to form that I think are giving the public a false picture of what's happening here. And one of them is that, you know, that the investigations are just looking into criminal violations. And that may be the case, but if that is the case, then I think that's a great disservice to the public, because there's a great range of activities here that could be involved, and a lot of them may never rise to the level of criminality. You know, if people are, you know, having meetings and making promises to the Russians, dropping sanctions and so forth in exchange for help on the campaign, you know, that may rise to the level of a criminal violation. But, you know, the criminal statutes are very, very specific, and it's really hard to get evidence against this. A lot of this is more of an intelligence gathering operation. And so, you know, one concern that I have as somebody who has lived and breathed this for, you know, since the beginning, is that they will focus so much on whether there was a criminal violation and not on exactly what happened, over the 2 years that this has been going on since the beginning of the Russians trying to do this. Actually, the hacking, as Karun said, goes much farther back than that. So, you know, if it's only focusing on the criminal violations, I think the public will never really understand the lengths to which Russia has done this, and also the lengths to which Russia has used what they like to call the useful idiot approach. And in that approach, which Clint Watts talked about during the hearing last week, you know, the Russians don't necessarily need collusion on the part of the Trump administration. They just need people to be sort of willing to do certain things without even realizing it, that are helpful to the, you know, the Putin regime, without actively and overtly engaging in an act of collusion. So, you know, if they're moving these pieces around the chessboard and telling, you know, Roger Stone, speaking hypothetically here, you know, that we have emails and we're going to give them to WikiLeaks or so forth, you know, I don't know if that's active collusion or if the useful idiot approach is a better one. And so, you know, I'm very curious to see whether the investigations really delve into this and come up with answers to what happened, irregardless of whether they rise to the level of a criminal violation. So we'll have to see about that.
Well, I think some in the Senate, including on the Republican side, have said that the important thing is finding out, I mean, McCain talked about it as an assault on our democracy and, you know, finding out just to what extent Russia has been active in campaigns to try to make Donald Trump president or to try to influence elections here in the United States, and that ought to be where a lot of the attention and a lot of the spotlight. And I'm appreciative of your pointing that out. But there still are, you know, possible criminal questions here, as James Coney brought to light. And I want to bring to light something else. And let me, if I may, go to you, Karun, on this. There are a lot of career professionals who are leaving the State Department, the NSC in droves. In fact, Rex Tillerson actually instructed his employees not to make eye contact with him, which is kind of incredible and bizarre for people who are working in the diplomatic field. Who's going to implement Trump's policies over there?
Well, I think a lot of people are asking that question. And is it even going to happen, quote unquote, over there? Or will it happen somehow just kind of cutting the State Department largely out of it? I mean, okay, you still have embassies around the world who are supposed to more kind of translate policy than implement the policy. But if the policy is carried out in a way that is more intimately focused, I suppose, in the White House National Security Team and the National Security Council and the inner upper circles of Trump's team, and potentially then executed with for the more heavy-handed portions of that policy through the Pentagon, maybe it stops being as diplomatic an endeavor. You certainly had a lot of meetings where you had a lot of meetings with foreign officials that have happened without Tillerson being at the table for various reasons, I'm sure. You have very, very few of his deputies, if any really at all of the top deputies, having been named, much less confirmed for their positions. I believe at this point we're up to one new ambassador who's actually in office, and there's a whole bunch of people waiting to see what's going to happen, and waiting to see whether that's going to basically whether things are going to suffer because there's no one actually in place that is an official appointee for with whom the buck stops to take responsibility about large portions of the world where we have had a fairly engaged diplomatic presence in the last several decades. Now that's not the case. Now you see a lot that's happening through the White House and a lot of, you know, scratching heads around Washington, especially in Capitol Hill, of when or if these people are ever going to get into their offices, get into place, and these teams be fully built out. But like you said, the State Department appears to be shrinking in the meantime.
Well, in the meantime, also, and let me go to you on this, Josh, there is an outsized influence on personnel matters that Steve Bannon seems to have. McMaster wanted to remove 30-year-old NSC aide Ezra Cohen-Watnick, and Cohen-Watnick appealed to Bannon. He intervened, allowed him to keep his job. Jared Kushner's going over to Iraq, and it would appear at this point that he's sort of a utility infielder or maybe also doing the outfield. I just was talking about baseball, so I've got that in my head. But, you know, the reality is he's being used in so many different ways by Trump, who seems to trust him. In fact, earlier today, Senator Grassley said, you know, that's okay if he goes to Iraq, if he has a president's ear, that's important. But in the meantime, there are all these positions that haven't been filled.
Right. I mean, I'm married, and I think it's great that my father-in-law trusts me, but, you know, I'm not the president of the United States, and I think, you know, there's a lot of people in the government, a lot of the career officials that think that, you know, that however smart and savvy Jared Kushner is, he's never been a government official before, that he's very naive when it comes to some things, and that there's certain things that you just learn through experience, whether it's as a state government official, whether as an ambassador dealing with diplomatic issues, foreign policy issues.
Well, forgive me, Josh, he may have some ethical questions anyway, because, I mean, you know, he's meeting with Chinese investors, for example.
Right. Well, that's one of many problems here is that, you know, he probably doesn't realize where all his blind spots are. He doesn't realize that by meeting with Chinese officials, even if it is in his business capacity, that there's a tremendous amount of potential for conflict of interest there. Hopefully he knows that if the Chinese are being very, very nice to him and maybe giving him a loan that for an over-leveraged building worth, you know, several billion dollars, that they might be doing it not just because they're being nice to him, but because they have some ulterior motives. I mean, I was talking to an intelligence official the other day who said that he has no idea the kind of bear traps that they're laying for him. And by that she meant that, you know, he doesn't really know what the Chinese have in mind, what maybe the Russians have in mind, other people that he's dealing with. I mean, you know, the Middle East peace process has not been solved, you know, despite the best efforts of some of the best diplomats we've ever had over a period of decades. So, you know, to think that he's going to come in and do it, you know, I think is some sort of, ludicrous in the minds of some people.
All right, this just in, 41 Senate Democrats oppose the Supreme Court nominee Neil Gorsuch. Enough for a filibuster. The GOP vows it will confirm him regardless. We'll talk about that and much more. Stay tuned. You're listening to Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. We are talking this hour about ongoing investigations. Obviously, House Committee still on it, and the Senate Committee and the FBI, and the concern about Russian meddling in the election. Also, about the Neil Gorsuch nomination. And as I said, this just in, that 41 Senate Democrats oppose nominee Neil Gorsuch, which is enough for a filibuster, and the Republicans vow it will confirm him regardless. There's your nuclear option, and you may want to comment on that. In fact, we do invite you to join the program and invite your comments on pretty much anything we've touched on here, anything you want to bring into the mix. Our toll-free number is 866-733-6786, or email us, forum@kqed.org, or go to our website, kqed.org/forum, and click on the segment or tweet us. Our Twitter handle is @KQEDForum. Talking with Josh Meyer, senior investigative reporter with Politico, and Karun Demirjian, who is a reporter with The Washington Post. And let me go to a call here. And Robert, that's you. Good morning.
Good morning. Thank you. My question is, Trump had mentioned that the RNC had been alerted to possible hacking and had taken measures to avert it. But now it seems, with what you had said earlier in the show with Rubio and Ryan, that maybe there was some measure of that. Is that going to be investigated as well? And how much do you think that would have affected the election?
Karun.
Well, I'm going to answer the second question first, which is that I don't think anybody knows quite how it would have affected the elections, because, again, remember, this hacking was not done in the way of saying, you know, voting machines or votes counted or anything like that. While it is not subtle at all, it's at the same time also far more subtle than that when you talk about, you know, fake news stories and different sorts of information spinning and public perception, manipulating public perception in a way which is not traceable in terms of every vote. So you can't say whether it would have had an effect on the election. It may not have, or it may have. The point is that it was meddling as far as the intelligence community is concerned, and that's problematic enough. And on the other point about, are they going to be investigating, you know, things related to Ryan and Rubio, again, I would just stress that this is not necessarily, it does not appear that this is going to be the same sort of hack in the style of the DNC, or that was necessarily done to the RNC. It's not even clear that it's a hack at all. You have to kind of distinguish between the terminology, because while hacking does happen, there's also just this sort of, you know, smearing stuff that happens on the internet through, you know, potentially just, you know, fake information being put out there or people focusing in on one politician in particular. The timing of this would have actually also been just around the time that the health care bill was falling apart, and they said that there was a campaign against Paul Ryan. That doesn't necessarily mean that his emails were hacked into. So is it going to be an investigation? There's an ongoing investigation on all parts of Capitol Hill about what sort of threat Russia poses, especially in this cybersecurity realm, and that covers all manner from hacks to just, you know, targeting to all kinds of things. So that's actually where this whole investigation started on Capitol Hill. Before we started talking about Trump, this was the root of it, the fact that Russians seemed to have interfered in the elections, and that that was just, you know, the icing on the cake of this bigger problem that we've known about but haven't taken seriously for years. So yes, that's being focused on, but as you can tell, based on where the news cycle and public attention is, that is not right now the central focus of those investigations that are also supposed to be focusing on that.
Yeah, and as I mentioned earlier, and Josh Meyer mentioned, Clint Wall's testimony brought to back how some of the deficiencies against cyber attacks are unfortunately too conspicuous and really ought to be of concern to all Americans. So I'm also inclined to ask you, Karun, before I go to another caller here, about what the Trump administration is doing now, or Trump is doing in his tweetings. President Trump is, you know, talking about uranium and the Clintons again, about Podesta having Russian interests, but also about questions that were leaked to Hillary Rodham Clinton before the debate.
Right. I mean, and I think the tweet was about how she hasn't apologized for that. And so there's so much coming out from Trump's Twitter account that is focusing, pointing fingers in other directions and saying, well, that's wrong, that's wrong, that's wrong. I mean, you know, it's a tactic. It's a tactic that people often use when they say, you know, when it somebody's accusing you of having done something wrong, point to everything else that they've done wrong and say they haven't righted that, so you're in a glass house, don't throw the stones. But I think that's pretty much what this is. It doesn't change anything about the investigation that's looking into Trump and his team and his surrogates and their alleged actions. And one other interesting thing I'd bring up, just because we've referenced Clint Watts and his research twice now, and that's that, you know, he also mentioned the fact that the president's tweeting habits help this sort of disinformation and propaganda spread. He was saying that there are at peak use hours, you will see a lot of these fake Russian accounts tweet conspiracy theories at the president in the hopes that they pop up on his notifications. He reads through them, retweets one of them, and lends it that much more legitimacy, so then all his followers pick it up as if it's really what's going on. And this is, you know, part of just the whole feedback loop of how this can work, where it's not a hack. It's not necessarily something that's done that's criminal. It's what was being addressed earlier as the whole, you know, the useful, well, it's the useful idiot sort of thing. So that seems like a very strong pejorative way of talking about, you know, something that involves the president potentially tweeting. But it's not necessarily, oh, you know, pre-thought out, but it's something that, oh, that seems plausible, retweet. And then all of a sudden, thousands and thousands of more people have glommed on to this thing that started out just being a complete spin factory, doctored up idea. That's where a lot of the concern is, that this is how this is spreading, and that the president's a tendency towards tweeting a lot of what he sees and talking about these things that sometimes are rested in the reality of alternative facts and not what everybody else is reporting is only helping this, helping muddy the waters so that people don't really know what's right from wrong and where to believe. And certainly, you know, when we see the Twitter tracks of today, you know, taking things that have a grain of truth in them that are just not what we're talking about right now is a way of making people focus elsewhere. And it's not possible to iron all of that out and say, well, okay, you know, the whole DNC question scandal. I mean, what does that have to do exactly with these meetings with the Russian ambassador? Not clear, except for that if you want to take that side of it, if you are somebody who thinks that this is a, quote, witch hunt, then sure, it makes sense to bring that stuff up.
Mike Haroon, I haven't heard alternative facts since Kellyanne Conway. I have to say, okay. But I have to say, incidentally, President Trump gave a great deal of legitimacy. Did he not, Josh Meyer, over the weekend, a Fox News story?
Well, yeah. I mean, one thing that I want to add, this sort of went back a ways in the conversation, but, you know, we were talking about the idea that the Russians didn't just hack the Democrats. And, you know, I wrote a story back in October about how the Russian hack of U.S. politics was much bigger than had been disclosed, and that it included the GOP, it included a lot of the campaigns for president, and it included some of the candidates themselves. But a lot of it was more their campaign operatives. And the important thing to remember is that, you know, this is a situation where the Russians and the Chinese, by the way, they've been gathering information, collecting intelligence on campaigns for years now, and they do it across the board. They do it against everybody. The difference is that they weaponized it against Clinton. But I think you can be safe to assume that they've also collected a lot of information about Trump and his campaign officials, and that they will use that when the time is right, whether it's privately to leverage people or publicly. So I think that anybody that assumes that this was just, you know, focused on one party or another misses the point. And I think some of that came up during the hearing on Friday. So, but yeah, I mean, I think the idea that Trump, you know, that people are tweeting these at him and hoping that he can help, you know, create the narrative, you know, that also came up on Friday in the sense that, you know, there's troll farms in Russia where there's, you know, 1,000, maybe a couple thousand people that are actively out there ginning up stories or forwarding the stories or spreading them or linking them or aggregating them, whatever they want to do, to create narratives here. And, so, you know, they're very sophisticated, and, you know, they time them so that they're at maximum value. The fact that they're targeting ways to try to get Trump to repeat them isn't a surprise at all. But that, to me, is really how they influenced the election. It wasn't hacking into voting machines. It was basically, or even releasing John Podesta's emails. That might have sown a lot of discord and distrust among the Democratic Party. But I think the bigger thing is using social media to advance narratives that tilted the campaign in one way or the other. One of the things that's important to remember is that, you know, they were trolling a lot of the Bernie Sanders websites and going after Hillary on those. And so that was sort of cleaving, you know, the voters, the Democrats, you know, in half, I guess, and basically telling them, you know, don't vote for Hillary, vote for Bernie. But that had the effect of losing them for the Democratic Party as they went into the general election. So it's a very sophisticated effort, and it's something that they're going to do again. I mean, they said that on Friday, Thursday, that, you know, that the next election cycle, you know, they're going to be doing this over and over again.
Well, they're active in France and Germany and Holland as well, we should mention.
Right.
And I'm going to look at a comment here from Paul or read it. And Paul writes, I'm continually frustrated by everyone declaring that the Russians didn't change any votes as if hacking the voting machines was the only way to affect the outcome. I would like someone on one of the congressional committees to ask, can you guarantee that the false information disseminated by the Russians didn't cause any voter to change how they voted? Here's another caller. David, join us.
Hi. Yeah, I was just listening earlier about one of the guests there, his comments about this investigation into one of the candidates, now one of the political affiliates in our American government, that they're investigating, criminally investigating this, and and their part inside this meddling thing, and then mentioning that, yes, it's just an investigation. There's not much we're going to really do about it. It's just an investigation, which is, but at the same time, it's being called a criminal investigation. In other words, a crime has been done here, and nobody's going to get prosecuted for it, even on the American side of anybody involving themselves, which kind of sounds like there's a somebody's involved in this on the American side. But yet, if I did that, I would be headed to the guillotine. And how do I know? Well, we can look back at Julian Assange, and they just can't wait to get their hands on him. But now it's like, you know, you're too president to fail? I don't know. I don't understand it. It's really a downer for politics and the whole spiel when it comes to this kind of thing. It's very depressing that you can get away with things like this. And how far is that going to go? And where does this go anyways? If it's not a criminal, if it's a criminal investigation, no one's getting prosecuted. What are we doing?
All right, David, you're raising a lot of questions here. And let me cut to the chase, because David Talbot, who writes a column here in San Francisco Chronicle, was pointing out in a recent column of his, Karun, that perhaps too much has been put in terms of criminal investigations in the way of faith on Comey. And he was reminding his readers that there were questions about Comey, particularly in terms of coming out with the information about Hillary Clinton, which may have influenced the election in many people's minds as much as possibly or close to the Russian meddling. And so maybe there's too much faith being put in Comey as the good guy here, the guy on the white horse.
Well, I think there's been whiplash around Comey. If you look back more than just the last 2 weeks or so, I mean, yeah, Democrats were not very boosterish on Comey at all. You saw a lot of them very, very vocally criticizing him for refusing to say outright whether the FBI was, in fact, investigating these alleged ties between Trump's team and Kremlin officials, even though we had reported, the Times had reported, many people had reported that that was, in fact, the case. But then you've seen, really, there was this turnaround that started to happen, and I think it traces back to about the beginning of March, which was right around when the time that President Trump started saying that he believed that he had his phones tapped in Trump Tower. And you saw reports, again, before this was stated publicly, you saw the report saying that Comey wanted the Justice Department to just put a muzzle on that because it wasn't true, because he just wanted them to make that go away, and it didn't happen. And the administration kept backing that stance. And then about 2 weeks later, you see him sitting in front of the House Intelligence Committee and in that open forum say, we are looking into these ties. I'm going to break with precedent. And I got permission to break with precedent because I'm going to say publicly that an ongoing investigation that I never comment on, we are looking into alleged ties between the Trump team and Russian officials. And also there is no there on this wiretapping front. And you've seen the Democrats just cheering him on ever since. So there's been a real political flip and a shift there in terms of where the allegiances lie and how much suspicion people have about Comey, and also just a change in Comey, who never said anything publicly at all about this stuff, and that just, you know, altered it in that moment. And even though he's still not commenting a lot of the details of what they're looking into, he also disclosed in that hearing that they have been looking into this stuff since July, which is longer than anybody thought prior to that point. So I think that the Democrats have this newfound faith in Comey to not be swayed by the persuasive winds to get away from this thing that's coming from the inner circle of the Oval Office. And just in regards to your previous caller who was expressing, who seemed upset that, you know, there's, you know, if we're having a criminal investigation, there's been a crime committed here, why isn't somebody being prosecuted? I mean, this is just a general comment, really, but it happens all the time that something bad happens and nobody goes to jail for it. It doesn't just have to be in like a political intrigue scenario.
We said the same thing after the economic meltdown during the Bush administration. Where were all those thieves of Wall Street? Why weren't they going to jail?
Or let's get even simpler about it. People get killed in hit and runs, right, or in shootings all the time, and not necessarily don't always find the gunman or anybody who actually did that. Like, and that's a lot more pedestrian, but like in any sort of, you know, guise, whether it's massive, you know, Washington D.C. election swaying allegations of what's been happening, or if it's just very simple tragedies that happen very close to home that we don't read about on the front page of the newspapers, this sort of stuff happens all the time. This is what goes into a society that where the rule of law is based on innocent until proven guilty. You've got to prove that all these dots actually connect to lead to something. Or, yeah, sometimes a bad thing that the intelligence community said happened during the election can happen, and nobody can be, quote-unquote, held responsible for it because no one's proven to be responsible for it.
How you make a very good point. You got to find smoking guns or fenders bashed in and forensic evidence and so forth. It can be very difficult on any level. Damien is next. Damien, you're on.
Yeah, hi. Good show. My question to you is more of a general question. In your research of the donors, is there any sense of what their vision for America is? In other words, are they just reacting to where social progress is going, or are they proactive in trying to create kind of their vision of America? And I'll take my answer.
Yeah, thank you for that question. I should mention Jane Mayer, who's been doing a lot of investigation into dark money, including, by the way, dark money in this Supreme Court battle, not only this one, but the one that preceded it with Merrick Garland, will be our guest in the second hour tomorrow. And I'm looking at a comment from Mary who says, Bannon has expressly defined his goal as gutting government. They're achieving that goal by not filling the empty positions at state and across the government. And that goes back to the question that was just raised by Damien, Josh Meyer. I mean, what's the end game here, or is there one?
Depends on whose endgame you're talking about. Do you mean the president's or do you mean the people around him?
Well, I mean the Trump administration. I mean, we may not be able to see it in a unified or monolithic way, but certainly it does. And there's a tremendous influence of money like that of there was with the Koch brothers who didn't necessarily get behind Trump. In fact, they didn't like Trump, but
there's
a lot of money behind Trump from Mercer that went into his campaign, like I said, that we'll talk about in tomorrow's second hour, and that continues to influence him and influence policy.
Yeah, well, I think that, you know, there's a lot of people watching very closely, of course, and that one of the things about Trump which made him different than other candidates and then other presidents is that he is not as ideological, you know, as other people. I mean, you know, if Mike Pence were president, you would sort of know where he stands on almost every issue. Same thing with Hillary Clinton and so forth and a lot of the other candidates, Rubio and Jeb Bush and so forth. But with Trump, there's always a wild card aspect to this where you never know exactly which way he's going to go on things. But one thing that we've and drain the swamp and so forth. But one thing that we've really been noticing as we watch this is that, you know, whatever his non-ideological approach to governing is, he has slowly and surely been, co-opted by the sort of, you know, the dark forces of money and power and special interests. So, you know, the same person that said we're going to be draining the swamp, now if you really look at the people that he's put in place as his leadership team, you know, you're seeing people that have been in the swamp all along, whether it's the political swamp here on Capitol Hill or certainly Wall Street, I mean, Goldman Sachs and so forth. So, you know, we're sort of watching this play out day to day. You know, the New York Times and some other places have devoted a tremendous amount of resources just looking at the conflict of interest aspect of this and finding that in almost every case, that they're putting in people at the different administrative positions that have tremendous conflicts of interest. So, you know, we don't know if there really is an end game here, but if you don't have an end game, you know, you have to be careful because you're going to be end up using somebody else's as yours without even realizing it. And one thing that I just wanted to add very briefly about the whole Russia thing again is, you know, we keep talking about where there is smoke and maybe there is fire and so forth. But, you know, as a very smart person who's been watching all of this stuff very carefully told me the other day, he said, yeah, you know, we keep looking for the fire, but, you know, the smoke is what actually kills people. So I'm not sure what you want to do with that metaphor, but, you know, I think it's apt for what we're talking about here.
I'm also looking at a comment from a listener named Richard who says, is it possible that Trump can't fill many of the current agency vacancies because no one wants to be tied to him? That may be a bit of a stretch, but there is certainly concern among many people about being tied to this administration, as there was with, the Obama administration, as there was with the Bush administration before that. Let me get another caller on, though. Jay joins us. Jay, you're on.
Yes, good morning. I just have a comment. I find it amazing that here we are, it's April 2017, and the Democrats are still blaming Russia for the election. Russia, they can't hack our polling machines. Our polling machines are offline. So the fact that our media outlets and our own electorate is unable to distinguish fake news from real news, it's our own fault. We lost the election, and I just wish that I'm a Democrat who got fed up with both parties after this election, and I wish the Democrats would just stop whining about what Trump did and start thinking about what they did not do, because these 4 years are going to go by fast.
All right. I thank you for that comment. We'll let it stand, and I'm going to go to another comment here and actually go to you on this, Karun Demirjian. Kelly writes, I heard that Russia created bots to create division in the Democratic Party during the primary and that they specifically created the Bernie bro archetype. Have you heard anything about Russia's role in the race between Sanders and Clinton?
Well, I mean, that Russia was, look, Russia was making entreaties to people across the political spectrum. It's not just that, you know, Russia said, hey, you know, our buddies in the Spider Republicans, so we're just going to focus on trying to sway the way that they think. Yeah, there was certainly a lot of Russian reach out to the idea that, you know, they would try to do this with potential Bernie supporters too. I mean, the entire plot line is to try to spin things in a way that would have been advantageous to Russia, or absent that, to just kind of sow some discord to undercut the confidence in the system for a few reasons. I mean, look, every place Russia goes and exports this sort of information politics campaign that can be very, very, that can sow distrust and discord, they never play just the far right or the far left. They always play both. And in this country, there's well-documented, you know, evidence to say that Russia was actually, as much as it was, you know, looking for allies on the far right, it was also looking for allies on the far left through the whole idea of, you know, the anti-fracking campaigns, right? Because, and that has nothing to do with the 2016 elections. It has to do with Russia not wanting competition for the oil and gas that it pumps out and exports, right? So you have a baseline of this sort of outreach having gone on well before the 2016 election that then could be exploited for the purpose of the 2016 election based on the ebb and flow of what was happening in the political campaign. So when Bernie was on the rise, you already have contacts in the community that's supporting Bernie that are skeptical of Clinton and they think Clinton will eventually win. Why not weaken the candidate that seems like she's eventually going to be in the White House, who has a really terrible relationship with Putin because of her history as Secretary of State? And if you can't even do that, and it, you know, so then that translates into the general election, right, with the Trump versus Clinton stuff. And all I'm saying right here is kind of parroting the logic that has also been espoused by members of the intelligence community as well. But at the end of the day, if you can't even, like, be sure that one candidate or the other is necessarily going to be your ally all the way to the fight, the one thing the United States exports around the world that Russia can't stand is this idea that, you know, democratic, representative democracy systems is a good thing, and it's encroaching on Russia's personal space. Russia does not like it when the U.S. and the EU and NATO get too close to its borders, get too close to its doorstep, and especially start to get into the part of the world that for much of the 20th century they controlled, if not through the fact that it was part of the territory of their country, the Soviet Union, through influence that they still want to wield. And that is what poses the biggest threat. So they were making these ties to groups that were amenable to their positions on various issues for years, that were there to then become, you know, part of a well and more swiftly woven together plan once you were in the 2016 election cycle, because those bots were there already, because those contacts were there already, and because you had people who were real people already trusting some of the information they saw coming out of this realm of the internet, which people, a few callers ago, one of your callers said, you know, it's our fault if we believe fake news. I don't know about you, but I have certainly, you know, in passing, seen a friend that I trust post something on Facebook that I think, oh, wow, that's weird, and had to do some real research to try to figure out whether it's real or fake. Not everybody is putting in 5 minutes of research to truth squad absolutely everything they read on the internet. Life happens too fast for that. So, yeah, to a degree, you know, shame on us for this having happened. But again, the bricks had been laid a long time before, and they were just used in this way once we got to this cycle, depending on where we were in the election cycle.
Yeah, well, Michael, I mean, I would add for that. I mean, this was a very specific
campaign. I just want to mention, this is Josh Meyer that you heard from, Kuro Demirjian before him. Go ahead, Josh. Sorry.
Right. I mean, there was a very specific campaign. This has been documented where these bots from overseas were going after all of the different Bernie pages and introducing rhetoric there, linking things from unfamiliar sites that were really full of virulent anti-Hillary Clinton propaganda. And people from some of the campaigns started looking into this, and they traced a lot of these to, you know, places in Eastern Europe. They looked, they found domain registrations for fake news sites popping up all over the place on pro-Sanders pages,
especially in Romania for some reason, wasn't
right.
it?
Right. Yeah. It was Macedonia, yeah. Romania, and places like that. So essentially, this was a very calculated effort, very coordinated effort to turn people against Hillary Clinton long before the general election, but basically in all of the Bernie, you know, websites. And so the whole Bernie bro thing and how they were turned away from Hillary to Trump, I think, is one of the untold stories about this. And I'm not sure that the investigators, when they're focusing on criminal violations, are really going to be looking at that. But that is one of the things that could have turned this election. You know, you have a lot of you know, sort of young guys who liked Bernie, and then all of a sudden they were looking for something to do, you know, once his campaign was over. And by then they were so angry with Hillary Clinton that they were very susceptible to voting for Trump or whoever the Republican candidate was. So that, you know, that's something that people, you know, if you talk to the general, you know, American public and tell them that that happened, they wouldn't believe you. But that is something that was happening during this campaign that has not gotten a lot of attention. And hopefully it will come out, you know, this and other efforts to do that, that very sophisticated efforts to find out what happened. And whether there was any collusion or not on the part of the Trump campaign, or whether they were happy to receive the benefits of this, remains to be seen. But it is something that happened.
Well, here's a related question. I'm going to get Rob on. I'm sorry. Did you want to add something, Corinne?
I was just going to interject. The one unfortunate thing about these investigations that are happening on Capitol Hill is that they are actually supposed to be wearing multiple hats, right? They're supposed to be looking into the political allegations of was there collusion between members of Trump team and Russian officials. But they are also supposed to be looking into what as a country are we supposed to be doing to ward off this sort of thing happening in the future, or ward off our susceptibility to be able to be swayed. And when you focus on one, it takes attention and oxygen away from the other, and that's just the unfortunate reality of what we're in right now. And because it's such a politicized environment that it's happening in, you see one party focusing in one direction, the other one focusing in the other direction. Neither one is wrong, but it becomes part of the political tug of war, and that's too bad because you have to look both ways at once in order to actually be able to deal with the fire if it's there and the smoke, which, you know, is the one, as you said, is going to be killing people first.
Rob is with us. Rob, seconds left. Please go ahead, because you're on point here.
I had a question about examples of fake Facebook accounts. You know, all these investigations have been saying there's office workers in Russia coming up with a fake accounts and posting on social media. Are there examples that can be shown to people so we can learn what the characteristics are? Just a general populace, when we see a post, we click on the person and see, oh, yeah, this has these kind of traits of...
Okay, now we're talking about the fire and the music's coming up, so we're going to have to bid adieu. But, Josh, any demonstrable evidence like he's asking for that people can look to?
You know, actually, I think that there's a lot of places online where we can get information about them. The Electronic Frontier,
the foundation yeah.
But, you know, there's a lot of places where you can sort of get smarter about this kind of stuff, and also protecting your own information to make sure that you don't get trolled as well. So, you know, two-step authentication is one. But, yeah, people have to be really careful because, you know, they're hacking reporters now. They're hacking a lot of – a lot of people are getting hacked that don't know it, and it's only a matter of time or circumstance before that becomes known.
Sorry to say we're out of time, but I have a listener who wants to know if Gorsuch was asked his views on filibusters. Good question to end on here. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation.